Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chain's procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which, according to the Prime Minister John Key, is good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is coming to us from New York. His name is Tom Hatzis, I believe. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Vince.
Could you just enlighten me just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do, mate?
Let's see. I do a couple of things. I'm an author, a writer. I'm a private educator. And I've worked at various times for different professors doing just freelance research, translating, a lot of footnoting, but it pays the bills.
What's your favorite area of expertise?
My area of expertise is actually has to do with witch ointments and certain drugs used during the Middle Ages, or I should say more like the early modern period. There were, clerically invented ideas about these poisonous ointments that witches used to fly, and I have my working manuscript right here next to me on that topic. I've been working on it for about, 8 or 9 years or so, and with a brief interruption to write another book actually about roller derby. The sport, the women's sport, and now I'm back to doing this stuff, the drug history stuff.
From roller derby to drug history, I think that would make a good title for today's interview, eh?
Yeah. Well, you know, many people have different, you know, all kinds of different interests, so, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't you go into that there? What would you say it was? A witch salve or a witch cream? Was that what?
Yeah, to be honest with you, it's a very, very complicated topic. I think a lot more complicated than many people are aware of, I should say. In short, there were different kinds of, there was a knowledge of different kinds of drugs. Although it's hard to tell whether common people knew that the active ingredients was, you know, were the magic words that they said over them, or if they were the actual alkaloids and, you know, pharmaceuticals or what have you. You know, just the drugs inside the plant, I should say, you know. So it's kind of hard to tell if they knew or not. I'm sorry, what was the question? I'm a little ahead of myself here. Sorry.
We're just wanting you to actually just sort of start off and explain what's in your book about the history of drugs and so on.
Okay, it's about the evolution of the concept of the witch's ointment, which was this magical paste that clergymen, some inquisitors, some secular authorities as well, believed people rubbed over their bodies, and that was the cause of their strange mind delusions. They would imagine that they were flying or some, you know, what have you. Or,
you know, the same thing happens when children eat the magical paste in kindergarten.
Yeah. Or sniff the glue, right? So what I'm trying to do is, because the witch ointment just kind of appears out of nowhere in the trial records, I'm trying to actually find where the concept originated from. And it's just this labyrinthian process, really, through folklore, inquisitorial records, demonological texts, alchemy treatises. It's exhausting, which is why I've been working on it for about 8 or 9 years now. It's a lot. It really is. But I'm just really trying to find where the concept originated from. There are essentially two schools of thought. One side says that the witch ointment was completely invented by the church and there was no real foundation. People just did not do drugs at that time. The other side says that, yeah, there were these salves and they rubbed, you know, people rubbed them on their bodies and that's why they had visions of flying. I am in the very unfortunate position of actually disagreeing with both of those positions. As in, I think that there's a little bit of truth to both. I do believe that the concept of a witch's ointment, like something that people rubbed on their, you know, arms or legs, whatever, this oil that they rubbed on themselves, the idea that they use that to fly to the devil is obviously a inquisitorial kind of addition, I guess we could say. Whereas I do think that people, I mean, not I do think, I mean, I've translated these documents, these old medical treatises. People clearly had knowledge of this stuff. I mean, it was not, you know, to say that they didn't is really, I don't know. David Hillman, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he had he wrote about recreational drugs in ancient Rome for his doctorate dissertation, and his thesis advisor, or his dissertation advisor, said to him, well, you know, sorry, well, part of his thesis was about the recreational use, the other parts were about medicine and other things that dealt with drugs, and they said, well, you have to take out the part about recreation. And he said, why? They said, well, because they just didn't use drugs that way. And it's like, what? Well, why do you think they're taking them when they're at banquets? Like, you know, when they're at festivals and parties, like, of course the people knew about these things. I mean, there were additives in wine. Dr. Hillman went on to publish a book called The Chemical Muse, which was essentially the portions that his dissertation panel said that he had to get rid of. But just the concept that people did not take drugs in the past is a little, I don't know, it seems a little too far-fetched.
I think cannabis has been used for 10,000 years minimum, according to recorded history, and recreationally as well. And it would be folly to believe that all types of drugs don't have any practical use in terms of any kind of form of recreation.
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, with all these drugs, I should say, it's also important to distinguish time and place. Because when you're doing history, you know, you're correct that, let's say, that people have been using cannabis for tens of thousands of years. I mean, it's one of the oldest drugs in use other than opium, right? Now, but if we were to say that people in Western Europe have been using cannabis for 10,000 years for its psychoactive effects, there's actually no evidence of that at all. They seem to have been ignorant of it completely. I mean, there was a whole host of other drugs that they had available, so it didn't matter that they didn't have cannabis. Although there is an interesting leech book from the 15th century from England that does mention cannabis. And, you know, it's here and there. You will see it. But, I mean, there were so many other drugs that were in use. I mean, it's cannabis just, it's not there. You know, it's not in the record enough to say that people did use it, recreationally, at least in Western Europe. There's no evidence of that at all. None.
Yeah, at that time, of course.
Not today, of course. You know, people in Western Europe are certainly smoking weed, which is a good
thing. Yeah. In terms of what kind of substances were people using back in the day in Europe and stuff like that, right? Like around the time of Rome and what have you, I mean, I was just under the impression that they were just getting drunk off copious quantities of wine.
Well, they were. They were doing that too. But they would also, I mean, they would put opium in their wine, or they would put henbane in their wine. They would put...
What's henbane?
Henbane, actually, I have some right here. This is henbane. It's a pretty somewhat powerful psychoactive, especially when mixed with other things like mandrake, saffron. And if you inhale it, which I do not recommend anybody doing, it can get pretty interesting.
Right. Okay. Well, so they're tripping out all the time. I was just wondering as well, I heard a rumor that the Renaissance came out of the ingestion of magic mushrooms. Like, apparently there was a huge magic mushroom sort of outbreak, a great spore explosion all across England, I think, at the time, and worked its way into the soil. And at the time, people, when they were eating their food out of the ground, they weren't cleaning it as properly as happened, so they were ingesting spores, and it started to help them have original ideas and so on, and triggered the Renaissance. Is that true?
Actually, that's one of the things I wanted to discuss with you tonight. I don't know if that's true. I really don't. I think that magic mushrooms seem to be, or different kinds of mushrooms, the Amanita muscaria, you know, different kind of psilocybin species. They seem to have been inserted into the historical record by some people. Jan Urban, who you had on your show, he kind of inserts mushrooms into areas where there really isn't any evidence at all. Many of his claims are absolutely, for lack of a better word, ridiculous. They really are. He doesn't do real research. He just doesn't. He says he does, but it's not. He doesn't. For example, in the Holy Mushroom book, he says he claimed, I believe on your show and I think on several other radio shows, he said that he went through all the philological evidence, right, against John Allegro. I'm correct in that, right? I'm not. He did say that.
I don't recall specifically, but go ahead.
He does not go through all the philological evidence in the Holy Mushroom. I don't know if you've read it, but I mean, essentially what he does is just publicize an already outdated but public debate between two guys. And the guy that he's debunking, Wasson, wasn't even a philologist. Like, he doesn't actually address the philology at all. So I don't know.
What is philology? It has nothing to do with Dr. Phil McGraw and his philology.
It's just the study of language, linguistics.
Ah,
yeah. But he doesn't actually do that in his book at all. And anybody could get it and read it. But you know, and see for themselves that he doesn't do it at all. He. I think it was on Red Ice Radio. I don't know if you're familiar with them. He was kind of bragging about how he did. He spent 3 days at a university library doing research. That's nothing. 3 days in a library at a university is not anywhere near the kind of commitment that this sort of study entails. It's not at all. My thing, I've been working on this for about 8 or 9 years now, translating the text myself from the original Latin from university archives, not the libraries, the rare books and manuscript archives from around the world. And anybody who does that kind of work can tell right away that Jan Urban does not know how to do that kind of work. And certainly, or at least he does not present in anything that he writes that he has the ability to understand that. He contradicts himself in public and in private on your radio show in particular. He said that he followed up the Holy Mushroom with 42 or 43 pictures that explicitly show the magic mushroom. Yet in an email to me, he said, well, no, they're not really explicit. I just, you know, I leave it there for people to make up their own minds. Well, which one is it? You see what, like, those are two very different things that he's saying here. He's also wrong about almost every single thing that he writes about those pigs. Do you have the Holy Mushroom handy?
No.
Oh, you don't? Can I give you just a quick for example?
Sure.
Sure, hold on. To anybody out there listening, though no one knows who I am, so I don't, you know, I'm sorry, but you're probably not going to get too much press over this interview.
I don't care. as long as we're talking about something interesting that happens to be true and has factual evidence behind it, there's no complaints from me.
Okay, so to the three people out there that will listen to me and have this book, The Holy Mushroom by Jan Urban, that he claims actually that I didn't read, but you could actually see my underlines and notes going through it, that I read it pretty well. And I've actually, even to the point where I circled all of his grammar mistakes, of which there's an abundance of. On page 115 of his book, he brings up this picture that I want everybody to see out there. You see
that?
You
have to put that a lot closer to the camera there.
Sorry about
that. A little bit higher, more to the side. There we go. Okay. Okay. I see. Yeah. There's a person in the middle that looks like a giant mushroom with all-seeing eyes on their skull or something like that. What is that?
Yeah, it does look like a mushroom. Here's the problem. It's not. And if you go on actually my website, which is rspsychedelia.com, that's ARSPSYCHEDELIA. I know that that's a little long, sorry, it's in Latin. But I actually wrote an entire piece on this picture and how everything that Jan Ervin, not just one thing, but everything he writes about this picture is incorrect. He says that on this that that's a hybridized mushroom tree, but it's not. He says that the man is shown holding a mushroom and holding his head, dancing under the influence of the mushroom. Actually, if you read the text, which I translated myself, this guy is dying. He's not tripping out. He's not having a psychedelic experience. He's dying from eating poisoned fruit. That's actually what's going on here. Ervin also says that this is from an alchemy treatise. It's not. It's actually from a bestiary. He says it's from the 14th century. It's not. It's from the 13th. He doesn't get anything right. If people are interested, they could go to rspsychedelia.com and check out another article called Mushrooms and Mommy Fortuna's Midnight Carnival, and they could read about other pictures, like on 122 and 123 in the same book. He has pictures that supposedly depict St. Martin. I don't want to waste all the time talking about this. Read the article. Everything he writes about this is incorrect. Everything. It's an illusion that he's creating. He's inserting these mushrooms into history where they don't exist. He writes about alchemy. He's never read an alchemy treatise. He can't, because he told me he doesn't read Latin. So how could he possibly read these treatises? Right? I mean,
unless somebody else translated them first.
No, sir.
Nobody's translated them yet?
I'm actually the first person to translate at least that one in particular, the one from the first image I showed you with the salamander and what looks like a mushroom. There's a whole text underneath that.
All right. Well, we're coming to break, and let's continue this on after that one. All right. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. It's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood doesn't go ahead, make my news. Back in a minute.
Alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly Zeke parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls, these hangman rope sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick, trap, rob, wreck, butcher, and murder the people that keep them terrorized in gangster Frankenstein earphone radio slavery for the communist gangster government and con artist parroting puppet gangster playboy scum on top. There is no escape from this worse gangster police state using all of the deadly gangster Frankenstein controls.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry about that. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Tom Hatzis is my guest. His website is ArsPsychedelia.com, ArsPsychedelia.com. Oh, my dear Delia. Now, you've been sitting here ripping on Jan Ervin. And apparently you're not done yet.
and with all due respect, I'm not trying to rip on him. I am just trying to address that his theories are absolutely, by and large, ridiculous and not actually accepted by most scholars. But I wanted to just read you two things, two responses from that one article called Mushrooms, Roasting the Salamander on Our Psychedelia. Carl Ruck, who Jan Ervin has mentioned on your show, and who I have a lot of respect for. I have a lot of respect for Carl Ruck, and I have a lot of respect for his co-author, Mark Hoffman. And so I sent both Ruck and Ervin the same article, you know, that I wrote about that image and how Ervin got everything wrong. and how Ruck, because he was, you know, didn't check, unfortunately, he was very trusting of Irvin's less than stellar research abilities, and he made an honest mistake. But I want to show you, just read to you, two very different responses over the same issue. This was Ruck's response. He says, "The image clearly illustrates the bestiary, not the alchemy text, and that the salamander is impervious to fire and poison trees. You're right. I write in haste merely to express my happiness in discovering that you are a real scholar, and that to say, sorry, that tomorrow is a teaching day for me, so we will have to wait until Tuesday. I welcome you as a friend, Carl Ruck." Right, very nice. We have had very nice conversations, very amicable conversations. This was Jan Irvin's response. "Yesterday, a family member or friend of yours contacted me and warned me that you were psychotic and pretending to be an academic and that you've been fired from the university for mental issues. It's clear by your fallacious attacks and excited, childlike emotional behavior that you do not have, that you have serious issues. You've gone on a rant, acting like a child." But keep in mind, this is a highly academic piece that he's talking about that I wrote, that Carl Ruck at Boston University agrees with me on, but I digress. He said, "You're acting like a child, having your family contact me." So now they didn't just do it on their own volition. "I told them to contact him to warn me about your mental instability. Any intelligent person knows that one single issue in a book doesn't debunk the rest of the book." Well, I could debunk his entire book. It's really easy. And when you fail to address everything as a whole, focusing on a single issue, which I didn't do, while trying to make it appears that it deals with the rest, well, your agenda is laid bare. Now, do you see the two differences, the differences between those two responses? One came from a real scholar, an intellectual, someone who reads Greek and Latin. And the other came from Jan Irvin. So that's why, I mean, he also says, he said in the same email, "Why not cite Robert Price?" It's something he also brings up in the Holy Mushroom. He says that Robert Price changed his mind about Arkaya S. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but some of your listeners might be. But actually, he doesn't. He apologized because he caused her like some sorrow due to, I don't know what, they had some kind of disagreement. But his exact quote actually on that issue says, "I did not retract any critical judgments I have made of her work. But I was very sorry to have caused her such pain." So what is Jan talking about? You know, he's always telling everyone to read all these people's books. It's clear he's not reading theirs. I mean, you know, it's insane. He keeps saying that I focus on a single issue. But yeah, that's because that was the point of that one article. In another article I wrote, the first sentence says, and because Jan, since he's so predictable, I wrote, you know, "People are going to say that I only addressed one issue, so here are so many other images debunked in his not very well written The Holy Mushroom book." I debunked several of them, and I'm actually writing a book now about how just fallacious the Holy Mushroom idea actually is. I'm not a Christian at all, but I'm not religious in any way, but there's no evidence for anything Jan Irvin says, because he's going to say that, "Oh, well, I'm an evangelical or something, and that's why I'm saying this." I'm not at all. And, you know, so anyway, I feel like I'm chewing your ear off.
I'm having some real problems over here. Can you still hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
All right, well, we'll just keep going. I've got to solve these technical issues in the background here. Skype just appears to be sort of frozen. And also, I haven't read the same source material as you, so I can't really comment so much on Jan's interpretation of it. So what I'm doing here is just kind of sitting and listening to you hearing the evidence laid out.
Well, the good thing about a scholarly argument is that anyone can check it. You know, Irvin wants to be taken like a scholar. The only thing I'm doing is taking his claim seriously and doing what I would do to any other claim of history as a historian. That's all I'm doing. And he's so mad. He's really mad. He won't debate me. And I've asked him in public, and now I've asked him in private, I should say, and now I'm going to ask him in public. Jan, whenever you want, You say my family member contacted you, said I'm crazy, said I was fired from my job, which I wasn't. I don't know what you're talking about. I actually just got home from work. I don't know what he's talking about. So I would love to meet him at the debate podium. But he'll never do it because he's a coward. He did the same thing to Johnny Enoch. Said, hey, why don't we have a panel discussion? Do you know who Johnny Enoch is? He's a guy who does a radio show as well.
I'm unfamiliar.
Oh, okay. He's an American. He does a radio show like yours as well. Talks about interesting topics, things like that. And, you know, he had Jan on, or he made some commentary about some things that Jan said. And, you know, then offered Jan, hey, let's all get together and talk about this, like, on the radio. Let's make this public. And Jan disappears because he's a coward. He won't debate anybody. He certainly won't debate me because he knows the second he meets me at the debate podium, he can't sell T-shirts anymore because I'd mop the floor with him.
Yeah, but would you? I need to reset here. I think we'll probably do it over the break, I think. So we've got about maybe 8 minutes or so. And this is interesting because Jan has said a number of times that he's an incredible debater, and anybody who wants to question him, he'll debate them and mop the floor with them. So this is quite new.
Oh, that is. I'm sorry to say, sir, that is such a bold-faced lie. This is my offer publicly, Jan Ervin. This is you'll see. He will not respond. He'll say that I'm being childish and on a rant and on a tirade.
Now, those are ad hominem attacks.
What?
And doesn't Jan promote the trivium saying that ad hominem attacks are a logical fallacy?
Oh well, let's actually get on that. If you'd like to discuss the trivium, which is actually how it's pronounced, because Jan Ervin doesn't actually speak Latin, so he doesn't even know that there's no such V sound in the Latin language. When you see a V in Latin, you pronounce it like a W. So when he's on your show talking about study the trivium, to anybody that reads Latin, we can tell that he doesn't know Latin at all because there's no V sound. It's trivium. That's how that word is actually pronounced.
Where did the Vidi Vidi Vici come from? We came, we saw, we conquer. Is that actually spelt Vidi Vidi Vici?
Well, it's pronounced Vidi Vidi Vici.
Okay.
Yeah, there aren't, not that Vici is a soft C, but also there aren't soft C's in Latin either. Not that that's relevant to these words, but, you know, but what I'm saying is these are the kinds of things that scholars know, but Jan Ervin doesn't. So he can only sell his ideas to people who don't know. What I think of the trivium, or at least how Jan Ervin presents it, is that he should probably study it before he tells everybody else to, because he is so illogical all over the place. I'll give you, for example, in his book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, he says something about, I'd have to find the page, about a person looking over a standing on a mountain could see that the world was flat. First of all, nobody ever thought the world was flat. That's just a made up concept called a shibboleth that Jan Ervin believes because he doesn't realize. Ah, here it is. It's on page 10. This is I have it as my favorite contradiction of Jan Ervin, at least in this book. He says, from as high up on any mountain as one could climb, the earth appeared to be as flat as a chessboard. Well, how can the world appear flat if you're on top of a mountain? Doesn't that negate flatness, that there are mountains? Right? But he doesn't get it. Are we frozen? Oh, I think so. Oh, okay, sorry. I wasn't sure if you caught that because I think we're having the computer problems again. But you know what I'm saying? Like, he doesn't, what else could I, I'll find another one for you. He says that the church also banned writing, in this book, which is, I don't know what he's talking about. That's just not true at all. The church has never banned writing at all. I want to say this because I he's very predictable. I know how he works. And before, when I said that he didn't address any of the other scholars, what he would then say to that is, well, you didn't either. Who are these other scholars? So here are just a few names. He never brings up in the Holy Mushroom Professor Godfrey Driver, Godfrey, excuse me, Driver, or the 14 others that signed this declaration. That these are all Semitic and Hebrew scholars from Cambridge, London, and Manchester who signed this thing about how just egregious Allegro's work was. Jan Ervin does not deal with any of those people. Okay, there's 15. There's also Dom Sylvester Howdard, who Ervin doesn't mention at all. There's also a guy named Levy, who, again, Ervin doesn't mention at all. So when he says that, you know, he likes to blame Wasson for all of Allegro's woes, but Allegro was denounced in the academic world before Wasson ever even heard of him. So
I'm back, finally. Sorry about that. Did you notice I was gone?
Yeah, no, I did. I did. Yeah. I was like, oh. But, yeah, so you wrote the message. Just keep going. So I hope that all came through. I know I talk kind of fast. I'm a guinea from New York. You'll have to excuse me. And I'm trying really hard not to drop the F-bomb because of that. And by that, I'm about it. No.
So
just some of the other professors and scholars of Semitic Hebrew and other linguistic experts who thought that Allegro was wrong, who Jan Ervin does not address at all, despite claiming that he addresses all the philological evidence. He does not at all. In fact, he doesn't really barely address any of it. He talks all about primary sources in this book. He's got about five in a bibliography that is really, I mean, I've had undergrads with more impressive bibliographies than this academic work of Ervin's. So I don't know what he's talking about. Again, he sells his ideas to non-academics, to anybody who, you know, has studied art history, who has studied ancient religions, ancient cultures, language. All of this stuff that Ervin is so mystified by is all very regular. Another, going back to the Holy Mushroom, and another one of his images that claims represents mushrooms that I deal with in Mommy Fortuna's Midnight Carnival, on page 137, he says that there's an angel holding three mushrooms. But they're not. They're three nails. This is a picture of the arm of Christi. Do you know what the arm of Christi is?
I don't know. I can't see the picture.
Oh, okay. The term with the arm of Christi, it means the tools of the passion, the tools of Christ, the different things that Christ suffered through, like the spear of Longinus, the three nails, the pillar that he was flogged upon, the whip. And what this is, it's not three mushrooms, it's just three nails. And to anybody that's familiar with art history, they know that that's what that is. They look at it and they look at this and say, no, what is he talking about? Like, what is he talking about? And the problem is he just doesn't know. He's just not familiar with any of this stuff. I mean, one of the books I'm working on right now is kind of in between getting this thing done. Because this stuff really isn't all that important. It's just fun. And nobody really takes Ervin seriously. So it doesn't, even the scholars that he thinks are on his side. I mean, I have emails and I don't want to blow their cover, but guys who he has brought up on your show and others and in his works that he says, oh, they agree with me. Some of them actually really don't. They might just be being nice to him. But when scholars talk to him,
well, hold on. We're coming to break now, and it's sort of cutting out your audio there. So we'll be right back in just a few minutes. Tom Hansis is my guest, ladies and gentlemen, from ArsPsychedelia.com, ArsPsychedelia.com. Back in just a few minutes on American Freedom Radio.
The way it's going to be.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream, just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seems. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. It's our final segment here with Tom Hatzis. And, we've been having a good session here debunking the work of Jan Ervin. Would you go so far as to call Jan Ervin a fraud?
Because
you told me over the break that you're biting your tongue quite a bit, man. You know, just be honest.
I have difficulty, honestly, I can't decide yet if he's inept or a fraud. I can't tell. I really don't know. I don't see how anybody could have actually put the amount of research and time and work into his topic that he claims to have done and have reached his conclusions. I don't know how anybody could possibly do that. Again, read the articles on rpsychedelia.com and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know how any, you know, so I can't tell. I think that in some ways he's a fraud. Again, to invoke my family like he did. To say that I was fired from my job, which I absolutely was not, that is just a gross lie. To say that I have mental health issues, isn't that an ad hominem? Wouldn't he consider that an ad hominem? Or is that the logic of the trivium? I can never decide. I see it's weird. Like, is his rhetoric stupid and his logic faulty? I don't know. You know, it's just apparently much of it is wrong. I will say that I do think in some aspects, and I'll agree with Ervin here, I think Wasson was duplicitous. I do think there was a cover-up with regards to the Dead Sea Scrolls by at least one of the teams, the team that Allegra was part of. I do not think that that cover-up had anything to do with Jesus being a mushroom or a penis or whatever it is, you know. Well, no, that's what the argument is, that he didn't exist, he was really just a mushroom. That there's no evidence for, was there a cover up? There does seem to be, a lot of the guys withheld a lot of their work. They just would not let go of it. But there's also a certain amount of power that comes with having that kind of stuff. So maybe they didn't want to give it up for that reason. You know, as long as they hold, you know, the lightning bolt, so to speak, they hold the power of Zeus, you know? But I want to give you just a quick rundown of, because the philology here is what's important, okay? I want to give you a quick, if you don't mind, a quick two paragraphs from my book that I'm writing, you know, when I'm not writing this other one, about the wordplay and punning with mushrooms. Kind of looks like this, okay? Sometimes words and such can seem like evidence to our modern minds. One of the stronger arguments coming from those like Jan revolves around wordplay and punning of ancient words to show that the people using these words were secretly embedding their intentions within them. Not surprisingly, considering that their messiah, Allegro, was a philologist. Etymology can equally be used for such purposes. For example, while on Alex Jones's radio show, Ervin, who does not read or speak Latin, explained to Mr. Jones that the word liberal comes from the Latin liber, meaning book. We are supposed to then assume that all liberals are smart because the name comes from books and people that read books are smart, right? Well, not always. You see, liber, i.e. book in Latin.
That's fallacious to start with. I mean, George W. Bush read My Pet Goat. That doesn't make him smart because he was reading a book.
Yes, well, you're right.
Nor does it make him a liberal.
What's that?
Nor does it make him a liberal.
Oh, no.
But anyway, continue. I digress. Go ahead.
I don't think I actually, because I'm not talking about being able to read. I'm saying that.
I know, I was just making a joke.
Oh, sorry. I suck. well, anyway, not always. You see, liber, i.e. book in Latin, is not the end of the etymological trail for the word liberal, our modern liberal. For liber actually comes from libir, the Latin term for the underside of bark. Yes, bark, the writing surface on which ancient Romans used to compose their books. The reader should be able to see, because this is from my book, should be able to see that just as Ervin tries to use Latin to prove his point, I, using the same linguistic trail, can show that Ervin ought to learn Latin before trying to use it to make a point. I simply followed the etymological trail one step further. Therefore, it is up to Irvin to demonstrate for us how, in our age of dictionaries, computers, word processors, and iPhones, how he doesn't know the full etymology of the word liberal, and yet ancient peasants living in the greater Palestinian area, without all those things, understood the root meanings for Amanita muscaria, a mushroom that doesn't even grow in the desert. Put it in everyday terms. Ask the smartest person you know if she can trace the etymology of liberal. Let's say, for argument's sake, your intelligent friend can trace the word to the underside of bark. Does this prove that, politically speaking, she is liberal, going back to your George Bush point? Of course not. She could just be a conservative that reads Latin. But let's grant it. Let's assume our Latin etymologist friend is liberal. Chances are her ability to trace the linguistic trail of liberal to underside of bark has little to do with her political standpoint. She's probably a liberal for, she is probably a liberal for many other reasons, of which etymology plays little, if any, role at all. To put it even more clear, my ability to trace Latin roots does not mean that my political philosophy is bark. Which, if you follow Jan Irvin's logic, that's what that would mean.
So is this why the liberals' bark is worse than their bite?
Probably. That's a good one. Wow. See, even I caught that. So, it's probably true. Their bark is certainly bigger than their bite, although not now with Obama spying on everybody. Now they're really barking loudly, and they're biting harder, too.
Yeah, apparently Obama's going to put out a new promotional TV series called A Game of Drones.
That's excellent. That's excellent. I got to say, I cannot believe the hour is almost up. Like, here's what's going to happen. Irvin is going to say, I did not address everything, but that's because we're out of time. So, whenever you want to, I would again. I know it was a pain in the butt for us to meet to do this just because it was the end of the semester, but and I was just busy as hell. I have so much more to go on because there's a lot of stuff he's going to say. Well, you didn't address this. Tom didn't address that. And anytime he wants to, I will debate him. I will debate Irvin and John Rush at the same time. I'll take them both on. That's somebody that agrees with Irvin. I have an article about John Rush's work on ourpsychedelia.com as well called The Secret Cult of the Radish, because I discovered if you apply the radish to a lot of the same ideas that they have, you could actually prove that there was a secret radish cult as easily as you can prove there was a secret mushroom cult.
How interesting.
Yeah. So, it's just they're really weak arguments. And whenever you'd like to talk again about any of this stuff, I would be more than willing. I have so much more to say on this topic and many others. This is my life's work. I do study the history of psychedelia. I talk to scholars, religious all over the world all the time over these matters. And I'll tell you right now, nobody agrees with Jan Irvin. Even the people that he, bolsters in public, in private, they're a lot nicer than me. I'll give them that. Again, that's the guinea from New York thing coming out. I don't know. The fact that Irvin was even hiding from Johnny Enoch, that guy seems like he's like the most innocuous dude ever. If you just, go to YouTube, type in Johnny Enoch.
I find that real funny how Johnny Enoch was the most innocuous person ever.
Just real quick, guys, I have to go to roller derby practice. This is my roller derby jersey, okay? It says, see, NYSE, NYSE, because we're the New York Stock Exchange. According to how Irvin works, because we have punned the New York Stock Exchange, we have something to do with the New York Stock Exchange. Actually, we have nothing to do with the New York Stock Exchange. But using their logic, you would think we did.
I disagree with you. I think technically everybody has something to do with the New York Stock Exchange because your birth certificate number is probably on there being traded as livestock as we speak.
Sure, that's a very, very literal. Sure, everybody does have... but not directly in that kind of way. Yes, I agree. I agree with you that what's going on in North Korea does actually affect me. I get it. But right this second, it's not really, I mean, I'm not losing any sleep right now. I'm going to still go to roller derby practice. I'm still going to live my life. So you know, you can't really take things like that so literally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We're just having a laugh, mate.
But anyway. Okay. And again,
well, that's pretty much the, we've got about maybe a minute left, so.
I just want to say, really, once again, thank you for having me on. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak. Irvin Orff, Simon Powell, who I didn't get to bring up at all, any of those people, have a panel to do something, by all means, I think that'd be great. Public statement to Jan Irvin, debate me. You say that people, I'm saying right now, I'm willing to debate you. I'll come to you anytime, any place, anywhere at all. You tell me. I'll be there.
You know, I would like to start hosting debates on this show because I think I'd be like a really good moderator, you know, with two people going at it hardcore and stuff like that. And me just kind of like, hey, come on, chill out, man. We're so angry, man. You know, let's try and keep it intellectual. Let's try to keep it intelligent. Let's try to keep it stick to the facts. Let's stop calling each other's names and stuff like that.
One more.
Well, hold on, Tom. We're done here, unfortunately. Tom Hatzis, ladies and gentlemen, arspsychedelia.com. We'll be right back after the break with another guest, ladies and gentlemen. See you in a minute.